Welcome to Wisdom at Work, Philosophy Beyond the Ivory Tower, where I interview people who translate philosophy into successful careers outside the academy. Or more appropriately, welcome back. I've been on a hiatus for the podcast, but I'm excited for 2013 guests coming your way. If you're enjoying the podcast, the best way you can support us is to write a review on iTunes, share it with a few friends, or post on social media. What does it mean to be authentic? Authenticity has become one of those watchwords in self-help culture. Unfortunately, over the last decade or two, it's become what I like to call Oprah-sized. A term formerly pregnant with philosophical meaning has been thrown into the grinder of American self-help culture and turned promptly into meaningless mush. The word has an older provenance, became central concept in existentialist philosophy, particularly in France and Germany in the early to mid-20th century. And my guest today, Sky Cleary, is an expert on existentialism. Her new book is called How to Be Authentic, Simone de Beauvoir and the Quest for Fulfillment. One of the fun things about this conversation is that Sky goes into some nitty-gritty detail about the relationship between Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. They're one of the most fascinating and few philosophical couples in intellectual history. Existentialism is often, I think, expressed as and understood as a very, very hyper-masculinist philosophy. You picture the rugged individual stoically, accepting fate. In this conversation, Sky takes us through de Beauvoir's philosophy, explains how she came to believe that she had, quote, accumulated the advantages of both sexes, how she found a way through the tragic pathos, you might say, to a post-tragic disposition and attitude toward reality, how to resist, quote unquote, absurd vegetation, and how we might think about the meaning and purpose of old age in a culture that doesn't have room for it. Please enjoy my discussion with Sky Cleary. Sky, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Great to be here again.
We were just talking before I started recording. I couldn't remember exactly the month that we spoke last, but I know it was in the belly of the pandemic. So a lot's happened since then. And of course, you've got a new book coming out in the US, which we'll be focusing on over the next hour or so. But I'm actually curious. I got the sense when we spoke last that you're somebody who's really plugged into like New York City life. Whether or not that impression's right, and I'm curious, as somebody who lived there for 9 years, I've been away for a long time, what is it like now that we're coming out of the pandemic?
It's bouncing back pretty hard, I think. I just spent yesterday walking around with a friend who was visiting. We went all through Central Park and down Fifth Avenue and the High Line and Little Island, and it's so busy. And which is great to see, people coming back and life getting back to normal. But it's also been, it's clear it's been hit pretty hard, with lots of shops have closed down and things like that. But it's lovely to see it's getting back. And what's also great is there are lots of events coming back, like events at bookstores and other places. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. I saw you're going to be at the Strand.
Yep, the Strand.
That is very exciting.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah, I miss regular access to that store.
Yeah, it's a beautiful store. So we're going to be up in the Rare Book Room with Regan Penaluna and Sam Rose Hill, who are both amazing women philosophers and academics and writers. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. So yeah, let's dive into the book. I know you were deep in the writing of it the last time we talked. And we talked a lot about your prior work, Existentialism and Romantic Love, which focused on a number of existential philosophers. So what made you want to write a whole book on de Beauvoir?
I was really interested in Beauvoir and authenticity because, of course, for my first book, I'd written on, as you said, romantic love from different existential philosophers' perspectives. And one of those chapters was on Beauvoir. But I just thought she, I knew she had so much more to say about authenticity, not just in the context of love, but much more broadly in terms of different life stages and different contexts and situations. So, and she didn't write, you know, a comprehensive book on authenticity. So, but it's a recurring theme, like throughout so many of her works. So I wanted to tease that out more and get a sense of how the different challenges we face in different aspects of our lives and how we can think about authenticity. There was a lot to talk about.
I mean, one interesting question that raises right off the bat is that I think when we hear the word authenticity and the way it functions in our culture, we often think of it means like being true to yourself or getting in touch with your true self. And that can sometimes raise the idea of like an unchanging self. But here you're pointing out the idea that, you know, what it means to be authentic when you're a teenager or whether you can be authentic as a teenager is a good question. But, you know, as an adult or as an elderly person, and I noticed in some of your writings, you talk about works that I wasn't aware of that she wrote, like a work on old age. So that'll be interesting to get into is what is her perspective on authenticity? So maybe as a starter, so authenticity is sort of a watchword in existentialists in general. What is distinctive about her approach to that concept?
Yeah, so what I loved about Beauvoir's idea of authenticity was that it's not about a fixed self or a true self, as you said. She takes an existential approach, which is existence precedes essence. So we exist first, and then we create our essence. So we create ourself. And so authenticity is that process of creating our essence or creating ourself in ways that we choose and towards goals that we choose. And so it's much not like an introspection, trying to find that sort of fixed essence or nugget within our being, but really looking at our lives, looking at the context of our lives, looking at our relationships with other people and how we can orient ourselves into the future in authentic ways.
So this idea that it's not about sort of looking inward to find the unchanging self, this is kind of an open-ended question, but what do you think she would say about the way that authenticity often gets used in popular culture or self-help literature? My intuition here, I'm curious whether you think it makes sense, is that what gets called authenticity in our social conventions and popular culture is often its opposite.
I mean, it's hard to know what she would have said exactly, but mm-hmm. I think what, and this is something else that's unique about Beauvoir's discussion of authenticity is that, I mean, often authenticity is kind of presented as, yeah, as I said, introspective, but also like an individual thing. That, you know, what is your authentic self and how are you doing whatever you want in life? And she's like, no, well, actually, authenticity needs to take other people into account because we coexist. We're in relationships. We're in certain situations in the world. You know, certainly it's not, I think I sort of was talking before about creating our essence, which is key to Beauvoir's idea of authenticity, but it's acknowledging our past, you know, because, you know, the existential idea is that we're the sum of our actions. So yeah, acknowledging, you know, where we've come from, what past choices we've made, what's happened to us in the past makes us who we are today. And also thinking about who we presently are and how we're presently making choices, but also how we're stretching ourselves into the future. So what becomes what we call the self is kind of this synthesis of the past, present, and future and where we're going. But and her emphasis is certainly on the future. And the risk with kind of more superficial ideas about authenticity in terms of finding out who you are is that you'll end up being, you know, very self-centered and selfish. So for Beauvoir, authenticity isn't about, you know, doing whatever the hell you like, because we share the same human condition. And she talks in The Ethics of Ambiguity about where we're all interconnected. And if we value freedom for ourselves, then we must value it for other people. And so if we value authenticity for ourselves, we must value it for other people and not, you know, block other people from, I guess, pursuing their lives in authentic ways.
That's helpful. In other words, like, so existence precedes essence doesn't mean that we just all do our own thing. There is still some recognition of what's common to us as human beings, namely that we are existential creatures, that we have this radical freedom. So there is some recognition, because I think that's a helpful clarification. I think it's sometimes like a caricature or straw man of existentialism is that it's just sort of a counseling hedonism, or, you know, doing whatever you want.
Right. And for all the existential philosophers, you know, freedom without responsibility is meaningless. Like you need both. This idea of radical freedom comes more from Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy, whereas Simone de Beauvoir was more attuned to the structures we live in. For example, she talks about a story in The Ethics of Ambiguity, which is, if you like are trying to go through, I think it's about, you know, banging on a door and trying to get through the door and it's locked. And, you know, according to Sartre's philosophy, it would be like, we'll just go around the door or find another, don't choose not to go through the door. Whereas Beauvoir was saying, well, if we think about oppression and exploitation and like how that door is open for some people, but not for other people. Well, that's a problem that door's locked for some people. And so what's important is to try and form solidarities, all of us to work together to open, you know, those doors for everybody. So she moved away from sort of Sartre's radical freedom. But another, I think, important concept for Beauvoir is that she talked about how existence is a constant tension between being for yourself and being for others. And like, if you're obsessed with being for yourself and don't care about anyone else, then yeah, you'll end up, you know, basically without any friends, but also, you know, that's a very selfish way of being in the world. And then there's being for others. And if you are purely being for others, then that suggests that you're either being exploited. For example, she was concerned with how women are so often cast into the role of being for others, of giving themselves up and caring for others and putting themselves second, which is why she wrote The Second Sex, as women secondary to men. So that being for others, where we're called to give away so much of ourselves, being in that too heavily in that realm is problematic as well. But she's like, yeah, we're partly for ourselves and we're partly being for others. And the ideal is to try and find a balance between those extremes, like a balance, she calls it being with others.
One quote that people probably most associate with Sartre is, "Hell is other people," from, was that in No Exit?
Or it was.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a hyperbolic phrase, but it is reflecting a core principle in his philosophy. And I'm very interested in them as a couple and as a philosophical sort of yin and yang, maybe. And I'm curious what you make of her as a feminist philosopher, because I always thought with Sartre, even before I know anything about Beauvoir, is that it was such a sort of hyper-masculinist philosophy. In other words, if the masculine mistake is to side with the being for oneself part of the polarity, the hyper-feminist mistake is to side with being for others. And so I always thought Sartre was just so clearly like toxically masculine, as we would say in today's culture. So I'm wondering about how you think her status as a woman, as a female philosopher, influenced and helped her see things that Sartre or other philosophers throughout the tradition, most of whom were male, missed.
You know, she was in a, you know, she didn't, I think her family originally had money, but then they lost it all when she was very young. And so, you know, while she had friends who had dowries and were being married off, she was expected to work because she didn't have a dowry. So, and actually she was pretty happy that she was going to be expected to work, because she couldn't think of anything worse than, you know, being forced to marry someone. And she was also lucky because she was very smart. So she was privileged in that way. And she ended up being able to go to the Sorbonne and get an amazing education. And At some point, she didn't initially really see herself as different because she said at one point that she kind of accumulated the advantages of both sexes because she was so smart and because the men at the Sorbonne, like Jean-Paul Sartre and Paul Nizan and others, kind of treated her as an equal, like an intellectual equal. And so it was only when, I guess, she was having a conversation with Jean-Paul Sartre and he said something like, oh, you know, you were brought up differently to us. And she was like, oh, yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not trying to give Sartre too much credit here, but, you know, it was really Beauvoir's thinking. But she was like, okay, yeah, I have had a different background. And so she started researching the second sex and realized, you know, and the second sex was all about her trying to figure out what is a woman? What does it mean to be a woman? And during that research, you know, she realized her privilege and recognized that she had had opportunities that so many other people didn't. And, you know, she talked to a lot of people and kind of, yeah, came to a much more nuanced, I guess, understanding of situations and women's situation as the second sex than someone like Jean-Paul Sartre did.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to your original quote about hell is other people, I mean, Sartre sort of said, well, you know, we're forever caught in these kind of sadomasochistic cycles of wanting to know, you know, that the what other people think of us so we can gain full self-knowledge. And so, and we need other people to help us understand our being, and that can be helped because we can't really truly know what other people are thinking. Whereas Beauvoir was like, well, maybe, but why does that have to be a hostile interaction? Like, why can't we sort of enjoy the differences between us and like appreciate it and find joy in those differences and not turn it into like a hostile thing. So she was able to sort of say, hey, let's overcome this, you know, this antagonism. And what's also interesting is that when later Jean-Paul Sartre, he promised that he would write a piece on ethics, but he never did. And then he did write some notes on it, which were published posthumously in a book called Notebooks for an Ethics. And in there, he really seems like he came around to appreciate much more of Beauvoir's perspective, like saying, okay, well, maybe not all relationships do have to be are necessarily hostile. Maybe there are ways to overcome it. And so in there, you really see, like, he was thinking that maybe Beauvoir was onto something.
Thinking more about Sartre, which I hadn't done for a long time, you know, it just sounds more like Hobbes existentialized, you know, this radical individualism, we're always, despite our best efforts, in an inherently antagonistic and power-based kind of relationship with other people, and an attitude toward nature as inherently indifferent or perhaps even hostile to humanity. A word that came to mind while you were talking about her approach is more like appreciation for the mystery, and that we have choice over how we regard the other, whether that's another human being, whether it's a non-human animal, whether it's, you know, the cosmos. And that choice is so consequential both to how we treat other people as well as the natural world. While I was getting ready for our conversation, I looked at an essay that you wrote where you quoted her at length. And I wanted to read the quote and have you reflect on it, because it was beautiful and struck me as getting to the core of what she was after, as well as what makes her vision distinctive from Sartre's, as I understand it. So in The Ethics of Ambiguity, she writes, "To will freedom, quote, is to will the disclosure of being in the joy of existence. In order for the idea of liberation to have a concrete meaning, the joy of existence must be asserted in each one at every instant. The movement toward freedom assumes its real flesh and blood figure in the world by thickening into pleasure, into happiness," end quote. So lots to say there, but what comes up
Yeah, a lot. One of the things that, just to go back to the first part of your comment, was that, and I've been wondering about this, because I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre recognized that, yeah, we need to take responsibility for our actions. But, the question is, well, fine, you do something that hurts someone else and you're like, fine, yep, I take responsibility. But what does that really mean in terms of actions? And I think Beauvoir takes it a little bit further to say that, yeah, we're responsible. And yes, actually, we're also, accountable for our actions. And we should hold one another accountable because we exist in this world together. We share the same human condition. And Beauvoir brings out a concept called intersubjectivity in a much more forceful and direct way than Jean-Paul Sartre ever did, which was, so intersubjectivity is about the mutual recognition and respect for one another's freedom. And that is about acknowledging that not everything is just about me. Like, we should be acknowledging that other people's lives are as deep and rich and as our own. And so, in terms of the quote you were just reading out, in that, celebrating the joy of existence, in that, whereas Sartre is a much more negative philosopher, and I think, talking about conflict and everything's caught in hostility, and she was like, well, no, let's overcome it, let's celebrate these differences, let's celebrate that, we will kind of bump up against one another, in our projects. Maybe we're competing for the same job at one point, but just because we're sort of getting in each other's way there doesn't mean we're oppressing each other. That's just, where other people become obstacles. And so she had a much more positive outlook in and thought that, why can't we base human relationships on friendship instead of an antagonism? And she thought friendship was much more conducive to, celebrating the joy of existence, and we should be intentionally looking for ways to appreciate one another.
So Ethics of Ambiguity is a, I think, a very intriguing title. What's the primary ambiguity in our ethical lives for her?
Yeah, it's really, well, how do we get along with other people when we're all trying to do our own thing? How do we're all trying to be authentic. We're all trying to, or I guess, orient our lives in authentic ways, I guess, is a more precise way of putting it. And if it's my, authentic dream to, I don't know, write another book, let's say, but someone else wants to write another book too, and someone can only publish one of them, then, how do we acknowledge that other people exist? And her answer is this notion of intersubjectivity. And the but she also talks about, in the ethics of ambiguity, and how we tend to, it's easy to kind of deny our freedom or shy away from our freedom or fall into, scripts about, how we should be behaving or what we should be doing in our lives, or to do what just go along with what someone else tells us, to go with the flow. Whereas part of the ethics of, ambiguous ethics, I guess, of authenticity is trying to, untangle that set of expectations of what other people want for us and what we want for ourselves out of life, like how we want to spend those precious moments on earth. While also knowing that other people are trying to do the same. And ideally, she said, ideally we would see a collective conversion where oppressed people would rebel, oppressors would stop oppressing, and we would all sort of get along. I mean, not perfectly, but and it's very utopian, of course, but she sort of saw this idea of utopia where we weren't always trying to, oppress one another, and everybody could stretch themselves into an open future in ways that they choose.
It sounds partly like we have an obligation almost to sit with ambiguity and sit with the ambiguity that is our condition, the anxiety and fear we feel in the face of that rock bottom ambiguity is what leads us to simplistic answers, is what leads us to sort of glom onto ready-made roles handed down to us from culture, social forces, and put people into categories rather than realizing how messy and in flux and ungraspable both other people and ourselves actually are.
Yeah.
And that's what's strange is like we know that at some level, but we are so quick to sort of override or push it down.
Yeah. And, you know, her, she talks about how, you know, we are, as you say, pushed into roles like being, you know, a good wife or a good mother or a good husband or a good worker bee. And, you know, those sort of roles are easy to slide into because, you know, there are precedents there and it keeps society nicely organized, but, you know, it squashes our authenticity. And, you know, the one of her key kind of foundational ideas is, I mean, I guess from Nietzsche, you know, Nietzsche said famously, God is dead. And so she's like, okay, well, if God is dead, if there are no, like, there's no one at the pearly gates to forgive us, and if there are no rules that we're kind of thrown here on earth and we arrive without a guidebook, and if there's no God to tell us what to do, then the ambiguity of the human condition is that, well, we have to figure it out ourselves, how to get along with one another. And it's not easy. But her proposed solution was that, well, these intersubjective relationships, like our bonds to one another in the earth, that's the foundation of ethics.
Got it. And I think that's the idea that we can relax into relationship or relax into bonds that will catch us, that will buoy us up, as it were. It's the refusal to, it's the fear that that's not there that I think drives the, like what I was referring to before as the hyper-masculinist, more Sartrean and stuff. I got to create myself. I got to project. I got to like make something of myself, because otherwise it's just nothingness. So that just opens up, that shift in attitude just seems to open up so many more possibilities. I mean, it almost sounds spiritual in a way that, you know, is anathema to the Sartrean disposition. Just listening to you talk, it's bringing up for me a framework that I've heard in a number of places that is really speaking to me. And I don't know exactly who the originator is, but it's the idea that there's a pre-tragic phase to existence, a tragic phase, and a post-tragic phase. So we start pre-tragic, sort of in Plato's cave, taking reality as presented by our society when it's just a story. And then the tragic is, oh, God is dead. It's all just, you know, a fable. There's no foundations for our morals. There's no pearly gates, like you said. We're just all making it up as we go along. And a lot of people, I think, and people who are attracted to existentialism, they get to the tragic phase. But that is going to run you into the ground pretty quickly and lead you to despair and cynicism. And I sense that's like kind of where Sartre got stuck. But it sounds to me like Beauvoir broke through to the post-tragic in some ways, particularly this idea that when I am living authentically, I'm getting more in touch with reality, and that brings joy. So it's not just like this feeling of consolation in the face of a hostile cosmos, but that like the more I get in touch with the truth of my being and the being of others and the being itself, the more beauty is being revealed to me, and probably the more moral of an agent I am becoming. So it's almost, it's bring up that like classical idea of the good, the true, and the beautiful as being united in a somewhat modern context.
Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, she, of course, wouldn't, you know, necessarily subscribe to sort of the platonic ideas of the good, true, and the beautiful, but she does say things like, what use is happiness if it hides the truth from me? And so she thought that, you know, why do we really want to live a lie? Like, no, she thought that, you know, there is beauty in the world, and, you know, even being lucid about our condition, about a human condition, can bring joy, you know, to figure out the truth of our lives. And yeah, I think when you're talking about the tragic, I mean, that's an interesting framework to think about it. And yeah, probably Sartre did get a little stuck in there. But yeah, I think Beauvoir was relentlessly trying to figure out a way beyond. And because, you know, she was her philosophy was mostly focused on freedom and responsibility, but there's a really strong undercurrent of like wondering about happiness throughout her writing. And she was constantly, you know, and actually in her student diary, she said, oh, I'm like, how can I be happy in life? And so, you know, thinking so, and I think that kind of focus on, or that latent focus at least on happiness and where and how we can find joy in life, it like carries through without her, throughout her work. And you know, I like the term you use about relax into relationships. I mean, I think she acknowledged that, look, there are always going to be tensions, and harmony is never a given. Like, we're always going to have to work towards. But you know, I think she in her life derived so much joy from her relationships and from her friendships. I think that sort of really comes through in her philosophy and informs her philosophy. And in fact, in one of her student diaries, she says, my philosophy must be from life, meaning that she wasn't trying to, you know, abstract armchair theorize, although there was some of that, but really she was like, okay, well, how is philosophy relevant to my everyday life? And, you know, I also want to mention that, you know, she was focused on, you know, authenticity is about stretching ourselves into the future again and again, but not in like this, you know, capitalistic hamster wheel, like not just to keep achieving and achieving for the sake of achieving. No, but what she thought is like doing something with our life and stretching ourselves, you know, being engaged in our own life is more valuable and more exciting than, you know, doing nothing or just sliding back into these prescripted roles.
There was a killer phrase that you quoted from her in describing sort of the apathetic posture, and was absurd vegetation.
Oh yeah.
that we risk like regressing into, which is when we reject existence. Or I guess more specifically, when we cede our radical freedom, or we fail to acknowledge it, and we sort of take shelter in something that's already been offered to us, a sort of frictionless existence. One way I can see this being a useful tonic for our times, very different from her time, is social media and technology and how ubiquitous it has become in shaping our life world. And the term frictionless I used is, you know, such a common one in Silicon Valley. The idea is to make things so quick and so easy and convenient and comfortable and on demand. And I'm wondering what you think her view of the human condition has to offer to help people wriggle out of some of the constraints that we are, as it were, thrown into. And that, you know, young people are thrown into almost immediately once they come into the world, constraints that seem to make it harder to realize and enact that radical freedom. And it's always hard in any age, but it seems like the deck is somewhat stacked against people, and particularly young people nowadays.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, she saw, of course, no social media in her time, but, you know, she traveled to America a lot. One of her observations was that, you know, especially in America, but certainly not the only places, like people become very obsessed with novelty and newness and want the next new thing, or become obsessed with, you know, TV show, like, it reminds me of like streaming TV shows where it automatically loads onto the next one, or, you know, TikTok videos where we're, you know, going through them and it's constantly sparking these like dopamine hits. But a concern with that when we're focusing on, you know, these fleeting moments of happiness and becoming addicted to these really kind of superficial things is that where if we're always going for the next thing, then we're giving the present moment like a death sentence in a way, because we're always, you know, undervaluing, you know, what's the choices we're making now, and always like going just for the next little thing. What she thought is that no, we need to, you know, appreciate our past, appreciate what we're doing now, and also think about where we're going, you know, longer term. And it doesn't matter if we change our mind or we go in new directions, but you know, this kind of focus on this tiny sparks of joy, it does turn us into kind of you know, absurd vegetation, as you say. You know, one framework to think about this is, you know, the being in itself versus the being for itself. And a being for itself is conscious, and it's like humans are, and we can change ourselves and make choices, versus a being in itself, which is like a rock. And so she's like, if we forget that we are able to take control of our lives rather than being kind of, you know, sucked into these, you know, social media or TV vortices.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, we become like a rock. And so she was saying, you know, we need to focus on being for ourselves as well, like in a collective sense.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, just following up on that too, it seems like when we think of freedom, I wonder whether she would say, I mean, I know, you know, somebody like Heidegger would say, Marx would probably say that a lot of the way freedom appears to us is in a shadow form or an inauthentic form, you know, where it's, you know, Coke or Pepsi, McDonald's or Burger King, swipe left, swipe right, like, or somehow they don't have a not like button yet, like, or just scroll to the next thing. It's these binary choices a system presents to us, and we get conditioned to thinking of freedom as, you know, choosing black or white, choosing A or B, and the constraints that puts on the imagination rids the moment of any ambiguity. It's one reason I'm finding this, the prominence of ambiguity in her philosophy so attractive and pregnant, is that it just widens the range for action. And it's like, it's almost like escape velocity. It's like, initially that freedom presents as so weighty, a responsibility to wield, like the gravity of a ship leaving the earth. It's so heavy. So you might as well, I'll just stay on earth. It's simpler here. but if you escape, if you punch through that initial anxiety over that freedom, then you break through into a whole new sphere of action and possibility. So, and it's scary because it's space, you know, a richer existence.
Yeah, I absolutely think that was where, you know, Beauvoir was going. And of course, she was very critical of capitalism, partly for, you know, the ideas that you were saying, that it gives us the illusion of choice when really we're not really choosing anything. And, you know, the why she sort of said, you know, lucidity is incredibly important. Lucidity in understanding our context, understanding our situations, understanding where other people are coming from, and understanding where our windows of freedom are, so we can kind of, you know, push through them. Because she didn't deny that there are facts of our lives that we can't change, or what she called facticity, not least including, you know, certain structures that we live in. But she was optimistic that there were possibilities for changing the structures of our lives. And she, in the 1970s and 60s, was campaigning for, you know, women's right to control their own bodies in France, and which led to, you know, legislative change, you know, when she created solidarities with other people. But, you know, this takes a lot of bravery. And, you know, a lot of other philosophers have talked about how for some women, you know, survival and resilience are more important than, say, you know, rebellion and challenging the status quo. And when you were talking about space, it reminded me of Kierkegaard, how he talks about how, you know, this anxiety or dizziness of freedom is like being suspended out over 70,000 fathoms of water. I don't know how far 70,000 fathoms is, but like being suspended over this like ridiculously deep ocean.
Oh, I didn't. That's great. I didn't know that that busyness of freedom quote was paired with that, with the ocean. That's great. Yeah, I actually was curious to hear more about her in relation to feminism. I mean, as you pointed out, she was sort of an advocate for, you know, all these women's causes at a time when that was, you know, edgy. What was her effect on feminism? Where would you place her sort of in the historical sweep of feminist thought and activism?
Yeah, so she was writing sort of towards the end of the period after what some people call the first wave feminism, where which was about women's suffrage. That was sort of the big focus. And during Beauvoir's time, you know, more women were working, but still the jobs that they had were, you know, lower paid jobs and, you know, with less possibilities for promotion. And there were still more secretarial jobs and things like that, not in leadership positions. So she came in around then. And so she was advocating for more women to go to work so they would be financially independent. I mean, not that, you know, financial freedom is like absolutely like the be all and end all for, you know, freedom of personhood, but she thought it was really important for women to be financially independent so that they weren't sort of channeled into marriage and having to depend on a husband. And that, you know, so she pointed out that, you know, having that independence would help women, you know, become more independent. And, you know, at the time, you know, during her life, you know, women were granted the right to vote in France. As I mentioned before, yes, she campaigned for women for contraception and access to abortion. And she was, she sort of authored and signed, it was called the Manifesto of the 343, which was 343 women, you know, a lot of famous women who had claimed to have had an abortion. And so, you know, the idea was to normalize it and say, hey, you know, banning abortions doesn't stop abortions. It basically makes abortion a class and a race crime because wealthy women will always be able to access it, but you know, but less privileged women will be kind of end up with either children they don't want or, you know, forced into back alley operations, which are incredibly dangerous. So that yeah, and I mean there were lots of other things she was sort of campaigning for, certainly supporting other women and other women writers was mm-hmm. was a big thing, and using her platform to help other people.
I mean, it's striking to hear that, you know, she was advocating for these causes, you know, half a century ago. And, you know, in light of recent political developments here, both with respect to abortion, but also, you know, how different our gender politics are nowadays. So, yeah, what do you think she would think about both the progress as well as the regression, at least, you know, from her perspective, from a lot of people's perspective, with respect to women's rights and women's place in society? Overall,
there has been a lot of progress, and we shouldn't underestimate that in terms of a lot more women working, you know, women's rights, no fault divorce, women are allowed to own property and establish credit, which they couldn't do when Beauvoir was younger. So, but at the same time, you know, I think she would be, you know, disappointed with the progress, not only Roe v. Wade being overturned in the US, but, you know, there are still so few women in leadership positions in private organizations and in government. Women are still, you know, overwhelmingly victims of sexual assault and domestic violence and human trafficking. There's still a gender pay gap. You know, women on average around the world, according to UN statistics, are still doing a lot more housework and childcare than men, even when they're working more than men. So, you know, there are still a lot of challenges that we're facing, even though there, you know, certainly has been progress in many ways.
Yeah. In one of your other pieces, you also focused on her writings on ageism, and the elderly. I'm interested to hear about that. It's not a category, at least to my knowledge, that philosophers engaged all that much throughout the tradition. And it seems like a particularly apt one in the modern period, in that the disruption of, I don't want to say the traditional family, but the village kind of social structure, where you would have had multi-generational families, multiple generations living with each other more, at best, you know, more integrated than the modern one. It's just more mobile, more nuclear, and so on. So I'm wondering, yeah, what did she think about old age and ageism, reflecting on it in her time, in her society?
Yeah, so she really struggles with growing older. And, you know, she was actually, you know, had internalized a lot of ageism. There's one story that she tells in one of her autobiographies, which is, you know, she was 39 years old, totally thought she was all washed up and was ready to, you know, retire herself to the shelf, she says. And, you know, she figured her sex life was over. And then Claude Lanzmann, who worked at the journal that she ran, who was, I think he was much younger than her, and he called up and asked her on a date and said, you know, do you want to go to the movies or whatever? And she was shocked, and she was like, you know, I hung up the phone and burst into tears, because and so she started this really intense relationship with Claude Lanzmann, and she said, I leapt enthralled back into happiness. And so I guess she realized at the ripe old age of 39 she could, you know, was still able to be a sexual being and fall in love. So yeah, and but then, you know, as she, even as she grew older, she's like, you know, I see my wrinkles in the mirror. And she was like, she started facing this identity crisis. Like, she's like, okay. Oh, and people started saying that she reminded them, yeah, she reminded them of their mother. And she was horrified about this. Like, she's like, but I don't feel old inside, but I look old. I look old in the mirror. I look old to other people. And so there was this like massive disconnect. And she was also horrified. I mean, partly that I think she realized she'd internalized this ageism, but also she was horrified at how ageist our society is, or societies are. And, you know, while, you know, there are some societies that have revered, you know, growing old in Confucianism and stuff, and mostly, you know, the people are treated as like elders are really highly respected, but of course it's mostly men, older men, that are being are highly respected. But she was, you know, really shocked that the older she grew, the more she realized that society treats older people as all washed up. And one, and she was against this, but she talks about it in terms of, I think it might be a Marxist language, in terms of exis and praxis. And she's like, praxis is like adults, because they're doing things and they're productive to society, whereas children and older people are classified as exis, which means they're not really contributing to society. But children are going to be future praxis, so they're like highly valued, but older people are sort of, I guess their abilities are like undermined, and they're sort of overlooked, and it's assumed that you know they can't really do anything, when the reality is that they're often doing so much, especially like a lot of people are working into old age and doing childcare and other volunteer work. You know, and how this relates to authenticity is that she thought that there were possibilities, even more possibilities for authenticity the older we get, because we're getting closer to the culmination of our life, and we have more experience. And, you know, maybe if we're looking at death, we're seeing like more urgency in our lives. So she wrote this book, Old Age, which is like this huge book, like 600 pages, which she kind of like copied a similar structure to The Second Sex, in that she analyzed old age throughout, you know, history, and then looked at, you know, how, like, sort of the situation of older people. But and she says things like, there's only one solution if old age is not to be an absurd parody of our former life, and that is to go on pursuing ends that give our existence a meaning. Devotion to individuals, to groups, or to causes, social, political, intellectual, or creative work. So she thought that, you know, being engaged in life, in whatever it is so important in old age.
It sounds like what she's saying is that the underlying human condition doesn't change, but old age is almost like an intensification of it, because you can't flee from death anymore. And in some ways that might seem to make it harder to live, but in another way, it makes it easier for you to access the depth of freedom there. So much of your existence is already behind you, as it were. So there's less to fall back on. In other words, like when you're growing up, there's so many prefabricated roles and structures and tracks for you to like just slot into, and then, you know, sort of ride along that for a while, and then it shipwrecks eventually, and then you have to face, like, you know, the abyss and nothingness and all that. But once you're older, like, you've been through all that shit. And yeah. So in some ways you're like, it's like you're less of a dupe. So the potential is greater, it seems like, to access those deep reservoirs of freedom, and that there's a wisdom in that. And if that wisdom is not getting communicated beyond the elders, because we've put them away in, you know, nursing homes, or they no longer live in families, then like the social order is getting kind of cut off from that deep current. Because it seems like, as you were talking, this like little argument was building in my head, like you can sort of judge the health of a society by how it treats its elderly, which is a reflection of its attitude toward death, which is a reflection of how free it is in this more authentic sense. That sounds like a pretty dark commentary on the way our culture has come to organize itself, but those connections just sound pretty intuitive to me.
Yeah. And you know, she said it's insane that, you know, people who are, you know, creating laws and regulations that are like dismissing old people don't seem to realize that they're going to get old themselves. And so what they're doing is creating policies for how they're going to be treated themselves. But you know, the problem, she also said, is often these people in power are often also wealthy, and so they sort of have the resources to cushion their own slide into, you know, old age. You know, she certainly said, yeah, old age is a great time to really let go of those expectations and roles that, you know, maybe we've tried to fit ourselves into. And you know, not everyone will take advantage of that, but she thought it's a good idea. And yeah, that we all need to work towards, you know, a ageism free world, so that, you know, we can enable everybody to creating their essence right up until, you know, even in very old age.
Speaking of old age, so Social Security, famously put into being by FDR, I was struck reading one of your essays that she likened FDR to Mao, in saying, you know, they were, as you know, equally dictatorial. Which seems, you know, absurd, of course, on the face of it. But what do you think she got wrong? In addition to that, moral equivalence.
Oh yeah, she definitely made plenty of mistakes. You know, one of the big ones is that she initially thought socialism would solve a lot of these issues that she was concerned about, but then she realized that, you know, more socialist societies were just as sexist and discriminatory as capitalist societies. Analysis of, for example, pregnancy. So one of the things I talk about, you know, she talks about how, you know, vomiting in pregnancy is an existential response to, you know, it's a sort of a physical rebellion vaccine against becoming pregnant and your body like changing. And, you know, so, I mean, I think hormones have a lot more to do with vomiting during pregnancy. So yeah, there are some things like that, that she certainly got wrong. But I think her framework of looking at, so some people wonder perhaps about, you know, neuroscience and whether, you know, neuroscience is sorting out, you know, what we can choose and what we can't choose and in what ways we're free. But, you know, I think that still fits within Beauvoir's framework, because she acknowledged that, yes, facts of our existence, facts of our body that we can't change. But even neuroscientists are finding that, you know, we can actually override our impulses, and we do seem to be able to make meaningful choices, even if we haven't discovered exactly, you know, the brain mechanisms behind that. And that's consistent with Beauvoir's existentialism.
For listeners who are intrigued by Beauvoir's thought, what is the best place to start, in your view?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, I think if you like novels, I think
other than your book, of course.
Okay. Yeah, the one I recommend most of all right now is, there was a novella published just in the last year or so, one of her long lost novellas called The Inseparables. Mm. And that was, you know, that's a beautiful story about what, based on a true story of her childhood friendship. And I think that's a really quick and easy place to start and to get familiar with some of Beauvoir's thinking about freedom and responsibility and facing death. But yeah, if people are interested, they can follow me on social media, Twitter and Instagram, Sky_Cleary.
Best of luck with the book tour. And I'm sure you just want to kind of kick back and think about nothing after all of the intense work, writing and editing and marketing and getting ready for a book. But do you have any idea what's next?
Yeah. So, well, this is a good question, but I am sort of working on another project for The Great Courses. So that's coming up. And then after that, I haven't settled on what the next thing is after that.
Got it. Rest in the ambiguity.
Yeah.
We will leave it there. Sky, congrats again on the new book. I'll post details about it in the show notes. Great to have you on again.
Great. Thanks so much, David. Great to chat with you.
So that wraps my discussion with Sky. Please check out her book, as well as my previous episode with her about her storied career or careers before she got into philosophy. And tune in next week, where I'll be interviewing Jason Marché on his new book, Wisdom, a Very Valuable Virtue. Again, if you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe on iTunes, write us a review, share it with your friends, and so on. I'll see you next week.